Welcome to the Jihadology Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Aaron Zellin, founder of Jihadology.net.
And I'm Carl Morand, the show's producer. This episode features an interview with Bernard Rougeau, professor of Arab civilization and society at Sorbonne Paris University. He is the author of the book Everyday Jihad, The Rise of Militant Islam Among Palestinians in Lebanon, and most recently, The Sunni Tragedy in the Middle East, Northern Lebanon from Al-Qaeda to ISIS.
In this episode, we talked about how Lebanese first got involved in jihadism in Afghanistan in the 1980s, and what these individuals did afterwards when they returned home, how the Lebanese scene became connected to the European and Australian jihadi networks, the role the Iraq War played in the mobilization and recruitment of a new generation, background and history on Fatah al-Islam, and what role Lebanese Sunni jihadis have played in the Syrian war and spillover attacks back home.
This episode is sponsored by the Winterfest, which is a sale going on now through the end of the year on some of the best apps for the Mac for researchers, writers, and academics. You can find out more on the link in the show notes, and I'll be telling you a bit more about some of the apps during the episode. But for now, here's Aaron's interview with Bernard Rougeau.
Syria, rightfully so, currently sucks up much of the bandwidth when discussing jihadism in the Levant. But next door in Lebanon, there has been major spillover effect, whether in terms of recruitment, financial networks, or even the entrance of the Shiite Lebanese Hezbollah fighting on the side of the Assad regime. Therefore, it is important to understand this angle. And today we have on the show the French scholar Bernard Rougeau to discuss the history and current status of Sunni jihadi movement in Lebanon. So, before we get to more of the recent events, it's obviously important to textualize what's gone on previously. Can you maybe discuss how the Lebanese first got involved with Sunni jihadism in the Afghan jihad in the 1980s and subsequently what they're up to when they returned home, and how this then also became connected to these networks in Europe and Australia?
Oh, it's a very complicated story, as a matter of fact. There were not so many, as far as we can know, there were not so many Lebanese with the first generation of Arab Afghans with Abdallah Azam. But there were a few, and there was one who was called Bassam al-Kanj, was close to Abdallah Azam, who got back to Tripoli in northern Lebanon, Tabrouz, and in the 90s, he wanted to emulate, in a certain way, what Abdallah Azam did in Peshawar and Afghanistan, that is to defend the Islamic Ummah against foreigners and non-Muslims invaders. And so I think it was very fun. He was following what was happening in Chechnya. And this is why he tried to set up a network in Tripoli in the second decade, I mean, starting from 95, 96. And then at the end of the 90s, he managed to recruit quite a lot of people and to have training camps in the mountain north of Tripoli called Sirat Diniyye. And as you know, this network has been fought by the Lebanese army and most of the people got killed, and also a lot of Lebanese military. But and afterward, the official version in Lebanon was they wanted to build an Islamic state or an Islamic emirate in Lebanon, or at least in northern Lebanon, which was not true, according to me. According to me, they wanted to recruit people and to train them in order for them to be sent to Chechnya to fight the Russian troops. I mean, he was really trained to emulate Abdallah Azam. But as always, and this is an important story, you have different, you have a succession of events, new networks inspired by the previous networks, but with other objectives. And we know many researchers are speaking about the three generations of jihadis, the first one with Abdallah Azam in the 80s, the second one with Al-Qaeda, and the third one right now with ISIS and the bottom-up networks in a certain way. And you can see all those kind of generations all those kind of different kind of militancy, Islamic militancy in northern Lebanon. Because after this failure in Sidi Diniyeh, people wanted to help at least the families of those who had been arrested or those who lost their fathers or brothers. And so they organized funds for the orphans and so on. And they attended the trial. I mean, they went to the tribunal and so on. And those guys managed to build a second network, what I called the McDonald Group. And they wanted to choose any kind of Western symbols to blow it up. And at the very beginning, those guys were, as Peter Newman called them, called this kind of organization self-starters. I mean, they didn't have any connections with Al-Qaeda and so on. But they managed to find, let's say, a leader who had linked with this transnational jihadism embodied at that time by Al-Qaeda. And so by chance, they were able to have this connection in Australia, because in Australia, you had many Lebanese who left Tripoli, northern Lebanon, when the Syrian troops got inside Tripoli in 86. So you have many Lebanese, I mean, proportionally in Sydney. And so they were able to have this connection with a founder who had a much more bigger ambition and who was apparently, his name is Bilal Khaz'al, at least very close to Al-Qaeda. So he was able to give them money and to reorient the targets so that they become much more ambitious. And they planned to blow up McDonald's in 2004. Hopefully they failed for technical reasons. The bomb didn't explode. But it was very interesting to understand that at that time, you have a certain kind of networks close to Al-Qaeda with those group of self-starters who tried to become professional jihadists and so on.
I want to take a minute and tell you about Scrivener, one of the apps that's part of the Winterfest promotion sponsoring this episode. Scrivener is a complete writing studio for anyone who's working on long, complex documents. One of the things that drew me to Scrivener was the ability to break down long documents into small chunks that were much easier to manage. So rather than looking at one long Word document, you can quickly and easily focus on the small section you want to work on. You can manage the sections and structure of your document in a traditional outline view, or in Scrivener's digital corkboard, which has index cards and a synopsis for each part of your paper. You can easily put different parts of the document side by side, so, for example, if you're writing the conclusion to a paper, you could easily reference the various sections you're covering. There are many more features that make Scrivener a must-have tool for writers, such as its beautiful full-screen, distraction-free writing mode, and its ability to display your research inside the same app you're using to write. Please check out the link in the show notes where you can learn more about Scrivener, download a free trial, and from now till January 1st, save 25% on Scrivener.
Can you start talking about maybe the Iraq War and how the recruitment and mobilization of Lebanese Sunni jihadis played out for this?
You have the third generation, people who were close to Zarqawi. We are now approximately at the same time, because Zarqawi wanted to build a network in the Levant. I mean, mainly in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Iraq. And you know something that is not quite well done, that well known, that I learned when I was in Jordan. Zarqawi was very fond of this fighter during the Second Crusade called the Imad ad-Din al-Zangi, well, Zonki, if you prefer, which was a very fierce warrior who defeated the Franks in the beginning of the twelfth century during the Second Crusade. And as a matter of fact, Imad ad-Din al-Zangi was able to have his own territory between Mosul and Halab, which is now what is exactly the same space as the one who is controlled, more or less, by the so-called Islamic State It's interesting to Zarqawi was very obsessed with the idea of doing something in the Levant. And as a matter of fact, it is this kind of idea which came over Ben Laden agendas. What we witnessed in at that period was that this guy who had no education, who was a guy from the street, managed to take over the jihad and to triumph over Ben Laden, the rich, the sophisticated guy. And so this network was called Jundesham, the army of Syria, of Greater Syria. And they wanted also to assassinate, and they managed to do it with at least Lawrence Foley, the U.S. aid employee. It was in 2002. I don't exactly remember the time they killed him. And so he managed to build a network from Afghanistan in Herat. You know, he had his jihadi base in 1999. And he met Shaker al-Absi, who became very famous afterwards, because he was able to control the whole Palestinian camp in northern Lebanon starting from 2006. But the history of this network is very important, because you can understand how Zarqawi was having his objective from a long time before we heard about him. And so just to understand that it is this network who became quite well known and who managed to build a jihadi base in Iraq and afterward in Syria. But what really I want to stress is that this third generation, let's say, was played a very big role in northern Lebanon. They managed to take control of this camp. And I think that it is exactly this, those people were part of Zarqawi network, as a matter of fact. It's also interesting to understand how they managed to control this camp, because it's the same tactics which is used now by the Islamic State in order to control villages and groups and so on.
I want to take another minute to tell you about Text Expander, another one of the great apps that are part of the Winterfest promotion. Text Expander allows you to create short abbreviations that you can expand into text, such as email signatures, addresses, as well as whole paragraphs of formatted text and pictures. For me, it is quite simply a must-have app on any computer I'm using. I love it because it saves me time and it makes me more accurate. In just the past 6 months alone, Text Expander has saved me from typing over 81,000 characters. Not only does it save me time, but it eliminates common mistakes. For example, I never have to worry about mistyping my email address, because rather than type the whole thing out, I simply type KJM and a semicolon, and it automatically replaces that text with my personal email address. If I want my phone number, I type PH semicolon and it pops in my phone number. Or for the iTunes page for this show, I type JIT semicolon and then the long garbled Apple iTunes link for the Jihadology podcast pops up in its place. Any bit of text that I regularly type becomes a Text Expander snippet, so I don't have to waste time repetitively typing it or worry about typing it incorrectly. Text Expander also has some advanced features, such as creating snippets with fill-in-the-blank areas and running scripts. Text Expander allows you to type more with less effort. Check out the link in the show notes to find out more about Text Expander, where you can also download a free trial, and till January 1st, save 25%.
Can you discuss the background and history of Fatah al-Islam and how it was connected to both the Zarqawi network and the Assad regime? The role that Sinaia prison played in this, and what happened at Nahr al-Bared in Lebanon?
I stayed a long time in order to understand the people who saw this phenomenon. They were able to have this kind of Orientalist expertise in a certain way. They knew what was happening between families, between tribes, people were frustrated with other groups and so on. So they were very clever in knowing exactly the anthropology in certain way of and the history of the camp. They were able to marry some women and so on. So this group made up of people who fought against the Americans in Iraq before and who were also using Syria as a backup base in order to fight in Iraq. Those people were well known by the Syrian security at that time. And you know, it was part of them were former prisoners in Said Naya jail and were so got freed in 2005, 2006, at a time when the Syrian army was obliged to withdraw from Lebanon. They were going to go to Iraq in order to pursue, to continue their jihad. But suddenly, they were asked, in a certain way, to change this strategic direction and not to go to Iraq in order to go instead to Lebanon. And it was a time when you had very strong international and American pressure upon the Syrian leadership in order for them to calm down the front in Iraq. And so you had also this guy who was part of the Zarqawi network, as far as I can understand, who was also a member of this army of Syria, Jean de Cham, who was a famous sheikh in Aleppo, Abul Karka. And Abul Karka was very close to Mustafa Dib Zeitoun, who is now a famous figure among the security apparatus in Syria. And Abul Karka told those guys to go to Lebanon and made sermons about convincing youngsters to go to Lebanon instead of Syria. And this was something which was asked to him by Dib Zeitoun. I mean, for them to go to Lebanon was something who made sense to them because they wanted to fight Israel. It was before the campaign, the Israeli campaign in Lebanon in 2006. A certain month, they started to go to Lebanon and they used, as you know, security cards coming from a very old leftist organization called Fatah al-Intifada. Abu Khaled al-Amli helped them. Abu Khaled al-Amli was an organic person, organically close to the Syrian apparatus. But according to many testimonies, even from people from Fatah al-Intifada that I could interview, they told me he was becoming very, very much religious. And so he said that the only way to win against the Israelis was to adopt Hezbollah methods, to be much more religious than they were before, to stop drinking, to stop smoking, and to act in a jihadi way. So you can find also among those old leftist organizations a change in values, a change in behavior, who was very close to what happened also to former officers, middle colonel, you know, from the Iraqi army. They started to be Islamized during Saddam Hussein last years in Iraq. And the same thing was happening to those leftist Palestinian organizations. So thanks to these old networks, they managed to get all the authorizations in order to go to Lebanon, even have some training in the Bekaa, and go to some camps, Palestinian camps in Beirut afterwards. Then they moved to the north and they were able to control this camp, to find support also from a large part of, not all of them, of course, not all of them, but some part of the Palestinian constituency who was not a constituency anymore. And so you can understand also how they can manage to have local support, not support of all the Iraqi or Syrian village, for example, but at least part of those who have grievances, who want to inside the tribe or inside the family, who want to have their revenge and so on. And so they were able to play on those social contradictions in order to make their presence more and more legitimate. And the only chance for Lebanon at that time was that they didn't want to attack the Shia, maybe because it was something with, maybe because they still cared about their, let's say, their Syrian official connections. But it was a kind of miracle in a certain way. because would have chosen to fight the Shia, things would have been much more worse in Lebanon today. So what I was trying to understand is the way they played on social and political contradictions, the way also some Salafi sheikh within the camp of Nahal Bared camp were trying to influence them, speaking the same Salafi language in a certain way, using the same categories to describe the world, but disagree with them on the practicing of religion and jihad, but were not able to impede their young students from following Fatah al-Islam and this jihadist organization within the camp. It was very interesting to understand when they told me that they lost any authority upon their students that they have been knowing for years and years, and who disobeyed their orders and followed instead this very weird organization made up of former leftist Palestinians and Syrians guys, and we didn't have any clear Islamic credentials, but we were trying to attract as much as possible young Saudi within their ranks in order to win some kind of legitimacy, exactly like the Islamic State, so-called Islamic State, is doing right now. That is to attract or to have people who have at least spent some time in the Gulf and preferentially in the Saudi Arabia, or have some degree in a University of Medina or any other Islamic institute, Saudi Islamic institute, in order to have this Salafi, Wahhabi, Hanbali legitimacy within their ranks. And some of them do know quite well the Islamic corpus. So what I've been trying to do is to find some keys of explanation, not all the keys, but at least some of them through what happened in Lebanon, in order maybe to shed some light on what is happening now in Iraq and Syria. And one of the key, not the only one, was a kind of class struggle within the Sunni constituency. Young Sunni guys who feel betrayed by their leaders, by their allies, and who want to have their revenge and to be empowered, at least not by others, but by, they think, by themselves in a certain way. After being, and so, you know, when there was, many of them also were unhappy with the Hariri family. They said that they betrayed them. They used to give them money at a certain moment in order maybe to fight Hezbollah or at least to defend the Sunni community. And they say that they did nothing. They were humiliated in 2008 against Hezbollah. And so they think that no, they will not trust their political allies, leaders, as it did before. And it sounds like young people who went with the Sahwat and who went through this experience, but who felt betrayed also by their own share, who were collaborative with the system, and they didn't get anything from their participation in the surge. So right now they prefer to join the Islamic State in order to really disapprove the way they were ruled by their former elites. So there is a kind of social struggle within the Sunni community, whereas in Lebanon, in Iraq or in Syria, and through those jihadi networks, not all of them close to the Islamic State, other jihadi networks also, you can have this kind of, see these class struggles. I remember also a Syrian refugee who told me 1 year ago that in Homs they were unable to impede youngsters to organize their own katiba, their own brigades, because those youngsters didn't want to obey the Sunni officers who left the Syrian army, because they were Sunni, not because they were Sunni, but because they were former officers. So for them, they still belonged to the old system. And this is why they didn't want to obey. They said, okay, we don't like this regime, and we don't want to obey those people who played with the regime for so many years, and we just now decided to set up the Free Syrian Army. So we don't want to obey people that we still believe are part of the former regime. And so we prefer to have that way, our own organization, own networks, own money from the Gulf, from Qatar, and so on, instead of obeying the Free Syrian Army organization. So all those things, I think, I try to see all those contradictions, attitudes, networks, differences of generations, the way one network was influencing others. There is always one or two guys who belonged to the former network and who became part of the new one with a new kind of action. And as a matter of fact, it was quite feasible. This work was quite feasible in northern Lebanon during the last, let's say, 10, 12 years, because it's a field work that I started to study long time ago, more than 10 years ago.
What has the role of Sunni jihadis in Lebanon been in relation to the Syrian civil war? Recruiters, foreign fighters, financiers, logistics for attacks in Lebanon. Can you talk about the varying attacks from Abdullah Azzam Brigade's Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State inside of Lebanon over the past few years? And what's the issue with what's going on in Arsal, which is on the Lebanese-Syrian border?
Yeah, recently I'm not knowledgeable as I was during the past, because of course I'm right now in Paris, quite far from the field. But what I can understand through Skype conversations and so on is, for the time being, for now, you have of course ISIS cells in Lebanon, but especially in northern Lebanon. I mean, you have the mainstream Salafi share are very close to Jabhat al-Nusra or Ahram al-Sham. There is some kind of confusion and ambiguity, because they support Jaish al-Fatah, for example, something that you can easily understand through their Facebook pages, for very easily. But you have also underground ISIS cells. And first of all, you can also observe that many Lebanese from Tripoli and from the region committed suicide actions against Shia objectives in Baghdad. Many of them were used as suicide bombers and so on. And you can also see that when there was the necrological page on the walls, or posters or leaflets about what they did, they were also always spoken as the Lebanese Fulan, or somebody who committed this suicide action. I mean, ISIS was emphasizing always their belonging to the Lebanese Sunni community, something which was never done by Al Qaeda, for example. Ziad Jarrah, if I'm not wrong, was Lebanese, but Ben Laden, only Al Qaeda only wrote that he was from Bilad al-Sham. Whereas ISIS is much more specific. Why? Because they want also, to exploit the Sunni bitterness against Shia objectives. And so it's quite easy for them to recruit young Sunni Lebanese to commit suicide attack in Baghdad and in Iraq. I mean, there are a lot. This is one point. The second point, when I say there are still many, I think many cells, or there are cells close to ISIS, because when you speak to them, when you have conversation, you can feel that many people are supporting, maybe not actively, but are supporting the Islamic State. What is very dangerous right now from Lebanon is, as you wrote it yourself, that the Islamic State is quite close to Homs. And the closer they get to Homs, the closer they get to the Lebanese frontier, the worse the situation can be in Lebanon. Those cells can try to act if they feel that the Islamic State is very close. In a certain way, there is still peace in Lebanon now, because there is a common definition on the threat. I mean, all the allies, whether Shia or Sunni, understand that those guys are threatening stability and threatening their own status, especially for the Sunni. So what, in a certain way, what maintains the peace in Lebanon is the fact that those guys are the common enemy of both Hezbollah and the Sunni civil allies, such as Hariri or Tamam Islam and others. they have this common definition on the enemy. So in a certain way, the war cities in Syria, for the in the midterm, I say, and the bigger the jihadist role in Syria, the stronger maybe the minimum consensus within this, the Lebanese society. But if the Islamic State gets closer to the frontiers, have a foothold in Homs, it will become very complicated to impede attacks like those who happened in the past. Those who happened in the past was, of course, the spillover of the Hezbollah rule in Syria, and people both from Jabhat al-Nusra and the Islamic State committed suicide attacks, as you know, in the past years. I don't want to go into conspiracy theories either, but at a certain point, let's say that the Hezbollah leadership was able to use this because it shocked the whole Lebanese society and especially the Shia community in order to justify its role in intervention in Syria, whereas in the past, this role was very much criticized within the Shia community in Lebanon. It is not criticized anymore because it has found a legitimacy in the protection of the Lebanese society and the Shia community in Lebanon. So, so this was the side effect, I think, of those suicide attacks. So I cannot be very. What also we are witnessing from certain people, and it also can be dangerous, is that people are making the distinction between Jabhat al-Nusra, those guys are good jihadists, and the Islamic State, the bad jihadists. And this is what also supported what the exchange of prisoners which happened and the happy hand in Arsal. But here I don't have a very clear idea about what happened. Negotiation with Jabhat al-Nusra, obviously, and a prisoner sweep. But sorry, Aaron, here I don't really know more than this about the Arsal situation.
Which network is currently more popular amongst the Sunni jihadi milieu in Lebanon, Jabhat al-Nusra or the Islamic State? And where do you see things going in the short to medium term? Will Lebanon continue on its fragile stability, or will the dam burst?
Quite very difficult to answer this question. I think that is, as I told you, if ISIS is getting closer to the frontiers, there will be much more problems in Lebanon with Lebanese able to take arms in some Lebanese, not certain fringes of the Sunni community, especially in the north, can act against the army in order to help. Here, it could be a very dangerous situation. In a certain way, if ISIS is far away from the border, the situation will remain as it is. Fragile but still stable. If it goes closer to the Lebanese frontiers, some people are going to move. Here, if it's not dealt in a very clever way, both by the army, Hezbollah, and Sunni allies, the government, or what we can still call a government, is there still any? It will require a very clever managing of the crisis, in order not to victimize further the Sunni community, in order not to let ISIS play its favorite role by saying we are true Sunni Muslims and others are apostates and so on. So this is how I will, you know, I don't give a very clear answer. I think if it gets closer, there will be operations, further operations within Lebanon, and here it will be very, very important, both for the Hezbollah and especially for the Lebanese army, not to act in a distinctive way, but to be able to have a strong Sunni support in order to act against those who are acting on behalf of ISIS without being anti-Sunni or without doing mistakes with the population. Because if such things happen, then everything is possible. So it will be absolutely the chaos and the catastrophe for the whole Lebanon.
Yeah, obviously we can't predict the future, so time will tell on that front. But at least now, after listening to this podcast with you, we have some history and context to better understand how things are and why they are and how this might inform future actions by the various actors. So thanks for coming on to the show today, Bernard.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Aaron.
If you have any feedback, you can email us, podcast@jihadology.net, or find us on Twitter, where we are @JihadPod. Also want to say a big thanks to Winterfest for sponsoring this episode. I've told you about Scrivener and Text Expander, but there are many other great apps that are part of this promotion, such as Nisus Writer Pro, DevonThink Pro Office, Tinderbox, BBEdit, and many more. Check out the link in the show notes where you can get some great deals on these apps. And it's not a bundle where you have to buy all of them. You can read about all the apps, download some trials, figure out which ones work for you and which ones you think will help you, and then save up to 25%. As always, the show is available in iTunes and Stitcher. And if you use one of those platforms to subscribe to the show, please consider taking a moment to rate and review the podcast, which will help more people find the show.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Jihadology podcast. Thanks to Bernard for coming onto the show and sharing his expertise with us. Also, thanks to the Podmaster, Carl Moran, for making sure this podcast sounds and runs smoothly. We will be taking a break from podcasting after the show and come back after the new year. Until then, I'm out.